WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory, straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Actually, I heard of it. It subconsciously mocks that lineage. But
So that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you watch the video of two protesters with Senator Jeff Flake in an elevator during the Kavanaugh hearings, if you saw them confront him with so much anger at the way women have been treated for so long, the way they said to a U.S. senator, "Don't look away from me, look at me and tell me it doesn't matter." If you look at the way Flake changed his position afterwards, it's all becoming clear that something absolutely remarkable is taking place in America right now. This is very much the subject of Rebecca Traister's new book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. The book combines a kind of history of women's uprisings with an analysis of the Me Too movement. Traister has written for New York Magazine, Elle, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. And her last book was called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. Rebecca Traister and I spoke on the very day that Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh both testified about her sexual assault allegations. Rebecca, there's no way to avoid this. We are talking now just hours after the Senate Judiciary Committee has done its questioning. There was a very specific story being told by Professor Ford as well as Ms. Ramirez and others in a very particular milieu as well. Mm. What did the specifics tell you?
The specifics of their stories.
Yeah.
Well, we are getting a very full and detailed view of cultures around wealth, white, fundamentally patriarchal power centers that begin in, you know, when people are teenagers, the prep school, the you know, Deborah Ramirez's story, which was about how she was an outsider to this very elite, fratty, hard-drinking, badly-behaved, relatively repercussion-free social circle of extremely wealthy, privileged white men who were all on paths toward immense power.
And the narrative of it was, when I was young and irresponsible, I was young and irresponsible. Boys will be boys.
Right. Who amongst us has not, right? Like that's about the sort of invisibility of certain kinds of power abuses. I write about in the book, and something that I've become kind of obsessed with in thinking both about how, for example, a Black Lives Matter movement has been talked about in a mainstream press, and then watching the same kinds of things around the Me Too movement, it's helped me to understand a little bit about how when power is abused in the direction that is sort of natural, the more powerful do something bad or harmful or even violent to the less powerful, it's sort of invisible, right? Oh, he was a drunk boy. Of course he did this. Like, what young man, what 17-year-old healthy young man with a sex drive and a keg, like, hasn't behaved that way? It's like indiscernible as harm in some way.
In your book, Good and Mad, you write very early in the book, "I am a white woman who has been angry in my life and my work, occasionally on my own behalf, but more often about politics, about inequity and the grotesque unfairness of the world and this country, how it was built, and who it still excludes and systematically diminished. And then you're off to the races. This book is in large measure about anger, the legitimacy of anger, the employment of anger historically toward good. What set you off on it?
It was an attempt to get my thoughts clear after the election. I was...
Did that take some doing?
Oh, God, yes. I didn't know. I was wrestling with what my job was. I was wrestling with what my work was.
How do you mean?
I was very muddy about what the story was that I needed to tell. I have to say that I haven't talked about this before, and there's a degree to which I was deeply obsessed by the question of the white women. I was acutely aware of my identity as a white woman, the degree to which my work has been blinkered by my whiteness, my work on feminism, the degree to which I have been pushed to be better, to think more clearly about race and class. That's been a big part of my evolution as a writer. And there was something that had happened right before the election. I'd been on part of a podcast with a bunch of women, and one of them had said about the white young white men who was like the classic Bernie supporter, like she had said something like, where are you guys out there trying to persuade people to vote for Hillary, because it's your guys, it's white men who are not voting for her. Where are the left white guys? Go get your boys, right? That was the phrase that she'd used. Go get your boys, right? And it was not a surprise to me that white women had voted for Donald Trump. But I was acutely aware of this demographic, and I felt some responsibility. And I'm very sympathetic to the argument, which is like, leave them be. It is not worth the investment in trying to persuade white women to be on our side. There's a woman in my book, Jess Morales, who says she worked on the Hillary campaign. And she was like, look, this was about persuading white women to not be Phyllis Schlafly. And that has never, ever worked. They're always going to be Phyllis Schlafly, right? I understand and have sympathy with that. Like, just let them rot, right? They want to support a system that fundamentally oppresses them and that oppresses other people. Great. But I felt that phrase, go get your boys, was echoing in my own head. And I think that part of what I wanted to do was also think about white women and what impulses and messages are at work on white women. And I felt like it was my responsibility to examine race from the perspective of whiteness in conjunction with looking at gender. And then the anger, so I was feeling that, but I wasn't sure how to do it, right? And that was the question about my work. How do I do that? What do I do? What is my job? What's the story here? But everything was so clouded. And I was on a walk with my husband between Christmas and New Year's of that year, 2016 to 2017. And I was trying to explain to him the despair I was feeling about, like, I not knowing what my role was supposed to be. What was my work going to be?
Professionally,
yeah. And I said, I just can't think straight, Darius. I'm so mad. And he was like, well, maybe that's what your work is. And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, well, maybe that's what you need to write about, is the anger. And as soon as he said it, he's not a writer. It was just something he was responding to. But suddenly in that exchange, I'm not exaggerating when I said it was the first feeling of like clarity and lightness in my head that I'd had at that point in 2 months.
It is interesting that a lot of the exemplars of constructive anger in the book historically are black women.
Mm-hmm.
Shirley Chisholm, Florence Kennedy, who I remember well watching on public access television for hours in her great hats. Rosa Parks,
mm-hmm.
and of course the mother of Emmett Till. That's not by any coincidence. That's not by accident.
No, not at all. Women of color have often been not only the leading activists, organizers, and the people who first gave voice and form to a lot of the transformative social and political movements that have reshaped America. They also often have done the thinking. I mean, Pauli Murray, who's somebody I write about in this book, Pauli Murray was credited by both Thurgood Marshall and Ruth Bader Ginsburg for the intellectual work she did laying out the framework for racial and gendered inequity in this country and laying the groundwork for the laws that would ultimately wind up protecting and trying to ameliorate the kind of gendered and racial inequality that she was trying to address. She's so very rarely credited as this leader.
And Florence Kennedy, I haven't heard the name Florence Kennedy in years. Yes. I mean, she's very much of the generation of Gloria Steinem, or a little even
she
older.
She was her speaking. She and Gloria Steinem were speaking partners
constantly.
On the road. Yes,
right. Tell us a little bit about Florence Kennedy.
So Florence Kennedy was a black feminist lawyer. She was outrageous for her time, but I think she would be outrageous now.
I think so.
In her demeanor and her willingness to be vocally, profanely, unapologetically, and joyfully pissed off about everything she was pissed off about. And there was a lot of it. She was mad about racism. She was mad about sexism. And she wasn't going to play nice at all.
Now, you wrote about a time when you were working in a male-dominated office.
Mm-hmm.
And you found yourself in tears. You're angry and you're crying until you write a chilly, hard-ass manager, those are in quotes, a woman, pulled you into a stairway and said to you, they don't know you're furious. They think you're sad and will be pleased because they got to you.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you working? What was going on?
Was at the New York Observer. I've never talked about this with the woman who said it, and I don't know if she even remembers. And I don't remember, to be honest, I don't remember what I was angry about. I mean, I can take guesses, but the thing that was astounding to me is that this is a person who had always intimidated me because she wasn't, there was nothing outwardly emotional, no sense that she was paying close attention to the experiences of the people. She was an incredibly efficient, incredibly talented manager of people. And of copy. And the fact that she saw in sort of what was a split second, something that I wouldn't have been able to describe, as soon as she said it, I was like, I am furious. Of course I'm furious. Like, of course I'm crying because I'm furious. I think that's such a common experience for women.
Which is to express what outwardly seems the sadness, but inside
yes.
is rage.
Yes. It's hammered home to us so often that our rage is fundamentally inexpressible because if we express it, we will not be heard. We will not be taken seriously. We'll be seen as, you know, crazy, unhinged, ball-busting, unattractive, invalid, marginal. Like, it will go badly for us if we express our anger directly. And I think that I write about this in the book, that one of the tactics that so many of us turn to, we cry, which is a fundamentally more acceptable mode of emotion for women. It is in part because of what that manager said to me. It will be understood as vulnerability, which is more acceptable in women.
To me.
Right. Now, that's especially true for white women, by the way. There's a racial dynamic in terms of crying as being something that can elicit sympathy. And that sympathy is very much more likely to accrue to a crying woman if she is white.
What are you saying? What is a woman of color more likely to do?
Well, women of color have written about this very beautifully, that the vision of the traditionally vulnerable femininity that garners sympathy or empathy is very often the suffering white woman. The crying black woman doesn't have that same kind of imaginative hold. And more than that, white women's tears have often been used to cover for instances of racism. So, I mean, it's the vision of the suffering white woman and the need to protect her has often been the cover for lynching, for for racialized racist violence. So I just want to, you know, when we talk about the tears of women being something that makes them vulnerable, that is a dynamic that applies especially if you are a white woman.
I really do hope men read this book in great numbers as well as women. And for me, there was an especially affecting moment that I'm going to touch on. Your husband comes to you. It's just as the Me Too movement is really exploding, and he says, I'm shocked. The profusion of it, the violence of it, the horror of so many stories that we've heard about in the last year about sexual harassment and sexual assault, it was all shocking to him, shocking to me. And he's coming to you in some way for what you call feminist absolution. So what's to be learned here? What can you tell him? And really, by extension, what can you tell me?
Well, I think that my hope is that this is a moment of education and readjustment of the view of a full human experience for a lot of men who have just not seen the have not realized how common, how ubiquitous, how everyday these kinds of experiences
aren't all men blinkered to some degree?
Sure, but this is part of opening eyes.
Right.
Men are learning something about the experience of not being men in the world that they've been blind to.
And yet much of the learning comes out in terms of defensiveness or...
For some. And it's a process. And
worry about, thinking about, oh my God, in high school, maybe I said something terrible. I made a bad joke in the office. That's what you're all about.
For all of my anger, and this is an angry book that I've written, and I am very angry at men, and I talk about the complexities of the tricks of a women's movement or a feminist movement, is that it asks you to identify as your oppressor. A group of people who are your intimates, your loved ones, the men you share beds with and families with and who are your brothers and your fathers and your sons and your friends. It asks of us to complicate those incredibly intimate relationships that are often loving and that are often based in need and dependence on the men on whom we rely. I really do feel for the men for whom this is difficult. We are changing rules partway through the game. That's what this process is asking us to do. That is hard. But there's no other way to do it. We don't get to just start fresh with a generation starting now, right? If you actually want to change the way that the power structures work and the abuses that they permit, and you want to say, actually, we don't want to have those abuses anymore. We want to make them no longer acceptable. That is going to mean that there are some people who are caught in the middle, who entered the world with one set of expectations and one set of assumptions about how they could behave and are being told halfway through that that's no longer acceptable. And that is really, that has a cost. It has a toll. And I do feel for those guys. That doesn't mean that I don't think the process is necessary and I stand behind it. And I don't think I'm alone in this. Most of the people that I know who are fervent proponents of the Me Too movement and of this difficult, painful process are incredibly conflicted about it, too. We don't want to be the police who determine if somebody should lose their job or not lose their job. And a lot of the anti-Me Too stuff says, oh, it lacks nuance and it's just a bunch of executioners. No, everybody I know who is behind this movement, most intensely and fervently feels incredible conflict. And so I feel tremendous sympathy for the guys, too.
The book, and it's a remarkable one, is Good and Mad. Rebecca Traister, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Rebecca Traister's new book is called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. You've been listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
That's Joan Baez singing at the March on Washington in 1963. Next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll look back at her part in one of the most tumultuous decades in our history.
You know, I think as I get older, sometimes I do, or somebody will show me a photograph, I think, oh my God, I was there, and those people were there, and Dr. King said what he said. And sometimes going into a, quote, historic moment, you know it, and other times you don't know it. In that case, I think by midway through the morning,
you knew.
We all knew it, yeah. Another word.
I'll talk with Baez about protest songs then and now. That's next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Another word.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and today is part two of our story, The Long Distance Con.
All right, now here's the deal, here's the problem.
Always is a problem.
In order for us to go forward now, there is a accumulated charge of $70,000.
We're listening here to a phone call recorded by a man named Terry Robinson in 2009 with his business partner.
Now, I want you to raise that $70,000. You're going to raise hell and say you can't do it, but think about it just for a minute.
There's no way I can do it, Jim.
Listen, I just don't say that. Okay. Just listen for a minute.
All right.
Robinson's partner was a West Virginia man living in Manila named Jim Stuckey. And some of the things Stuckey is telling Robinson are kind of extraordinary.
What this means is we can get the monies that we've been talking about taking out of it.
Right.
Plus $1 million. All right. Now, that is not the great advantage. The great advantage is somewhere in the vicinity of 20 to 25 trillion dollars, counting the value of the gold and diamonds and cash and all these other things. If you can find, even through your friends or something like that...
You heard him right. He said trillions. Stuckey said he was involved in a project to get U.S. bonds, currency, and gold bullion out of the Philippines, where the treasures were said to be in secret locations guarded by poor tribal people. Now, if you're thinking, how can I get in on this? I should tell you that the story is very much like a number of scams based in the Philippines, including some investigated by the U.S. Secret Service. And Stuckey himself once defrauded a bank in Maryland. Robinson recorded his calls with Stuckey, suggesting that he might have been suspicious, and yet, for over a decade, up to the time of his death, he sent Stuckey hundreds of thousands of dollars. His kids lost their inheritance, and his wife lost the house.
I said, you know, you cannot send that man any more money. You're enabling him. And, after he died, I found out he sent him another $14,000, and we didn't have $14,000.
Terry Robinson's daughter, Maggie, was left with the tapes of the phone calls, and she began trying to understand how her father, who had been so confident, so successful in business, had fallen for what seems like an obvious scam.
Sometimes a large sum of money makes a big difference.
A large sum of money, well, then I'll become a genius again. Everybody will want to, you know, be close to me.
Maggie decided to go and meet the man responsible, although against expert advice. In last week's episode, she talked with Maria Konnikova, a New Yorker contributor and author of the book, The Confidence Game.
I mean, tip number one, don't go.
Konnikova thought if Jim Stuckey were a con artist, he could be quite dangerous.
And don't underestimate old men. They are people who've been con artists their entire life. And if you think they have end-of-life regrets, think again. I mean, I don't think Jim is going to assault you, but someone else might.
And not only that, she was afraid that Maggie might get conned herself.
And he's going to talk to you and he's going to seem nice and you're going to say, oh, like, you know, maybe he's not such a bad guy. Once that happens, and they breach kind of the distance between the two of you, that's the moment that objectivity stops. That's why it's always very easy to tell when other people have been conned, but the people in the con can't tell, and we judge them for it.
Here's part two of our story, the long-distance con.
So what are we about to do?
We're about to get on this plane to Manila to go meet Jim.
Okay. How do you feel about it right now?
Right now, honestly, I feel good about it right now. In this moment, I feel good.
I'm in the Hong Kong airport on a layover to Manila. I'm with my producer, Daniel, who's asking all those questions, and my husband, Ben, who is a very nervous flyer.
I really don't want to get on another plane. This sucks.
Daniel is worried about something else.
Do you ever think about what, like, Maria talked about?
You mean when she was like, you have to remain vigilant? I have had to block that out.
I just talked to the security guy. So if you're Jim, his point of view, why are you coming unless it's to get some kind of revenge for all the...
Yeah, I mean, I would probably think that too.
The security expert said that if Jim was a big-time con artist, then he might be well-connected in Manila's criminal underworld.
Let me see the other thing the guy said. I wrote it down. And he says, if the guy is really scared, he can make people disappear for a couple of bucks.
Cool. Jesus Christ.
He said we have to go with the assumption.
The assumption that we're going to be murdered.
Or just disappeared.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now descending into Ninoy Aquino International Airport. Please return to your seats and ensure that hand baggage, loose items, larger devices such as the phone.
Hey, yeah, we're just at Bay 8.
Yeah. We walk out of the airport into the humid Manila night.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
Oh, thanks,
Baboy. Baboy, our driver, picks us up.
How are you?
Good.
Good, 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 good.
I'm exhausted and nervous about being here. All I want to do is just sit in silence, but Baboy won't let me.
So I was... Are you really into... interviewing treasure hunters?
Yes.
When Daniel first hired Baboy a few weeks before our arrival, he explained a little bit of Jim's pitch to my dad. Basically, that Jim had a way to access hidden treasure in the Philippines.
It's just funny because, like, it's so weird that, like, we just hired you and then it turns out you know treasure hunters.
It's really a coincidence.
How are these people related to you? How do you know them?
He's my landlord.
Baboy is the first person I've met in the Philippines. And it turns out he knows a ton about treasure hunting.
I rent one room in his house.
I mean, his landlord is a treasure hunter.
He always tells me that you cannot find the gold if you're greedy. You have to have a clean heart to get this gold. Or maybe he's also greedy.
Jim Stuckey presents himself as a middleman between the people who want to buy the treasures and the people who say they know where the treasures are.
Hi.
So what's up?
They were here again today trying to make a decision either with the silver coins or with gold bullion to raise the money. And they have promised to make the decision on which one they're going to have and be back here tomorrow with it.
When I started learning about this hidden treasure story that Jim got my dad to invest in, it felt like there was no way this could be true.
And the money and the gold belong to the Mahalika tribe.
That poor tribal people have been watching over gold bullion and U.S. bonds all hidden in caves throughout the Philippines.
You know, I got really excited about the Malakai tribe thing last week, but...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I said I got really excited about that tribe up north, Malakai.
There are lots of of crooked when it comes to gold, no? No, they will ask money in advance because they will say, it's the primitives that are guarding the gold, we have to pay them, something like that. But never deal with these people. They will really show you this money from the States. That's Wells Fargo. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. Jim talks constantly about Wells Fargo.
The Wells Fargo has to be brought here.
It's crazy.
To do that, I have to get the Wells Fargo in here first, then bring the eight pallets in, and that's going to cost some money.
I couldn't find the people Jim claimed to be working with, but we did find one treasure hunter who would talk to us.
Really?
Yeah, it's the guy. So it's the son of this guy who claimed he found the gold in the 70s.
He's Rojas.
He's Rojas' son.
Yeah.
We're going to meet Henry
Rojas,
the son of the most famous treasure hunter in recent memory.
Yeah, yeah, it was his father.
Yeah, it's his father. It's a very known story because he had pictures of it to prove that he was the one who found the golden Buddha. And the golden Buddha, you can open the head, and there's lots of diamonds there.
After his father died in 1993, Henry took up the treasure hunting profession himself.
Okay, guys.
All right. Awesome.
Okay, sir. Sorry for the place.
Thanks so much for bringing us to your house. As soon as we got to Henry's house, he started showing off his loot.
This one is 18th century, 16th century coins. We get that in treasure hunting. This one, bayonet, like that.
After looking at the stuff he found, we took off from Henry's home in the city to a nearby farm. The farm's owner had hired Henry and his crew and their metal detector to look for gold on their property.
Do you hear anything?
Some metal, ma'am.
Can you tell what type of metal?
This one is 40. Metal.
Like iron, you said?
Yeah, iron.
It's wet.
Oh, yeah.
Is that going to be something you could sell?
Yeah, we cannot sell that one.
So Henry found a piece of metal he couldn't sell.
You always go with the good luck.
Good luck.
Only good luck. That's all I want.
Yeah.
What did you think of Henry?
Henry?
Yes.
For me, I believe him 50%, and I don't believe him 50%.
What was unconvincing about him?
He's not rich. He should have been fucking rich right now. And he's been doing that for ever since...
I think it was about 25 years, 26.
25?
Yeah.
Imagine that, doing that for 25 years and finding nothing but helmets and lamps and Japanese bayonets. If I am to find gold...
Just like the boys unsure about Henry, I don't know how I feel about Jim. I don't know if he was actively scamming my dad or if he himself was being conned. The way to find out was to stop putting off what I came here to do. What I was frankly scared to do. I had to go back to Manila and meet Jim.
That's Maggie Robinson Katz. Our story concludes in a moment. And by the way, if you missed part one, which we aired last week, you can find it on our podcast or at newyorkerradio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi. I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've been listening to Maggie Robinson Katz's story about her late father, a successful businessman who lost a fortune in a very bad business relationship, or possibly a scam, in which he sent hundreds of thousands of dollars to a man in the Philippines named Jim Stuckey. Maggie went to meet Stuckey, who agreed to an interview. And we'll pick up with Maggie, her husband, and a producer in a car in Manila. And riding along with them is a security consultant.
The most common threat in Manila traffic, so-called tandem motorcycle riding shooter, which would be coming on that side.
So explain what a tandem motorcycle shooter is.
It's basically two guys on a motorcycle, one driver and one shooter, coming up on the side of the car. Sitting here, I have much better view of what's happening behind, and I can also pull you down to the ground if it's necessary.
That's great.
Well...
The security experts we talked to, there were several, all had really clear advice about meeting somebody like Jim. Meet him in a public place, hire security guards, and do plenty of recon beforehand to figure out the safest possible location.
Is this a safe area?
Yeah.
So me, Daniel, my husband Ben, and some security guards went to check out some spots where we could do the interview with Jim. One of them was a fancy mall.
Yeah, no, this seems like a good option. It's a world, Seattle's best coffee.
As we walked along, I kept noticing old white guys, thinking every one of them could be Jim.
What's that phenomenon where you like hear about
watching
a certain car and then you just see that car everywhere? Like there's a guy over there, and he's reading a John Grisham novel. Like he's got some intel.
We left the mall plaza and drove a few minutes to an opulent hotel called the Shangri-La.
Is this like the nicest hotel in Manila?
I know this place. I've seen the hotel name on documents Jim faxed to my dad. Is this the place where Jim took some of his phone calls? Sitting in this elegant marbled lobby as my dad pleads for money?
That's the same guy. He stood next to us, looked at us, and then went up. Yeah.
He followed us.
While I was talking to the security guards, Ben noticed that one of the old white men I thought could be Jim, the one who had been reading a John Grisham book at the mall, He was suddenly in the lobby of the hotel.
How long did he stand near us?
Like a minute or two.
Holy shit.
Same one?
Yeah.
It's the same guy. Yeah, it's the same guy who we saw.
At the Seattle coffee place.
It's definitely the same person.
100%.
Ben then saw the man was on the second floor of the lobby.
He's right up the stairs, sitting there. There's like a live string band playing, and he's like sitting in front of him reading his book.
Do I just ask?
Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me, does your name happen to be Jim Stuckey?
No.
No? No, okay. What is your name?
I'm Todd Smith.
Charles Wolfe?
Todd Smith.
Todd Smith.
Yeah.
Todd Smith looks nowhere close to 92 years old. He doesn't have a West Virginia accent.
Wasn't him.
Yeah.
He's not Jim. I'm going nuts. We leave the Shangri-La Hotel and drive back to ours. I sleep badly. I swim.
It's about 3 a.m.
I record my thoughts.
I wonder what he does all day.
I drink at the poolside bar and try to think about and not think about meeting Jim.
I don't know if I'm afraid anymore.
And then one morning...
Oh, man, I am feeling...
I go back to the Shangri-La Hotel.
I'm feeling a little nervous today.
Two undercover security guards go ahead of me, blending into the lobby. I don't see them as I walk in, but I do see an old man with white hair, white skin, white clothes, and a big belly. He's staring straight ahead.
Are you Jim Stuckey?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Maggie.
Maggie.
Hi.
It's 90% blind. I need no. an operation. In about 2 weeks, I'll have an operation.
Maria warned me that he would say he had a health issue. Is this a trick to get me to sympathize with him? Or am I being unfair to an old man?
Is that okay?
It's okay. I don't have an appointment until almost 1 o'clock before
Great.
I have to...
We have all the time in the world.
Okay.
Catch up like old friends.
Yes. Really, it doesn't matter. I'm happy to be able to participate and tell you how Terry and I were involved in these things over here. Depends on how much of it you want to know.
I want to know everything.
You want to know everything?
Everything. That's why I'm here.
Well, all of this really started back. You could go back when God created the world. When God created the world, he also chose...
Wait, we're really starting at the creation of the world?
Not only that, but when the war ended in Israel, the Ark of the Covenant and 5,400 gold artifacts was brought here. And we know within a general area, and we have a brochure. It's not for publication because it's not cleared.
I'm struggling to focus on what he's talking about.
The original association between Terry and I was profit-motivated. However, when we got into the Philippines and we saw what was going on over here, then our interests changed from profit-motivated to humanitarian services to try to help the people. Every tribe needs millions of dollars, and the money is available. I have some things here I can show you that has probably got 2 to 3 million tons of gold in it, and probably that much in other assets, such as Chase bonds, a currency called Wells Fargo, other things like this.
So taking it back just to like the pure relationship between you and my father, I'm curious in like how would you describe my father?
Very generous, well educated, and well informed.
Do you miss his daily phone calls?
Oh yes. I miss the wisdom that he had. He was a good business partner in addition to a good friend.
And how did you find out that he was sick?
Oh, he called me.
Do you remember what he said?
Yes. He called me one day and said he had been to the doctor. And the doctor had told him to put his house in order that he was going to pass on. And in about a month, he did pass on.
How did it feel when it kind of sunk in?
Well, to tell you it was anything other than a sad feeling, I would not be telling you the truth. You cannot work that long with someone without them being an intricate part of my life. You know, we always wonder, what is God's plan when he takes somebody that is so active in trying to help others? I also ask myself a similar question. Why did he take Terry and let me live this long? I'm now 92 years old. I'm in good health, mentally, physically. Work every day.
How much do you think my dad lost in the end in this project?
I have no idea. No accounting really was ever made of it. I can only say that the two of us together put in several millions of dollars.
Would you say that
my loss was roughly $4 million, not loss, investment. The only one that was supposed to return money was an estate that placed some $34 trillion in the state for the use.
Such insane amounts of money.
Insane amounts of money, but I'm telling you, it's real.
I mean, I just have to ask, because it sounds so fantastical when you lay it out, and I just have to ask, did you con my dad?
Did I call your dad? Many times I've called your dad.
No, I'm asking, did you con him?
Did I con him? I guess that would depend on the definition of con. If you think that I caused him to do something without his 100% knowledge, no. Did we get into things that did not work out? Yes. Was it a loss for both of us? Yes.
And just to be clear, the statute of limitations are up, so there's nothing legal. I'm not going to sue you or anything. So I just want to ask you again. Did you con my dad?
No. Is that a straight enough answer? If you have any reason to believe I did, then lay it on the table.
Just the amount of money that was put in. I don't understand. He retired. He had a nice life.
We both had a nice life till we came here.
I mean, in the end, you know, I lost my inheritance. He left my stepmom with almost nothing. She had to foreclose her home.
I understood that. I understood that. The last few conversations we had, he talked about his financial status had depleted.
How do you feel it all turned out for my family?
Well, I think at the end of the day, your family is going to be very happy and very proud. And unless I'm sadly mistaken, the financial assistance that Terry put into this thing will be multiple times repaid to his estate. I have no obligation to do that, but I'm going to see that it's done.
In this moment, I feel like my dad, getting told by Jim that the money is coming soon. I've heard it all before.
Are we finished then?
We're finished.
Check, check, check.
While I was interviewing Jim,
okay,
my husband Ben had moved all our stuff to a new hotel. The security guys told us to do this in case Jim had been a master criminal. When I got to the new place, I told him what Jim was actually like.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like the thing that's so fucking nuts. It's like Indiana Jones shit. Like, that's like every word. Ancient secrets, like going back to biblical times, like the Ark of the Covenant, like these are all here and I alone know where it is. Like
the Ark of the Covenant?
He brought up the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh my god.
He did say that he had a bunch of paperwork, but that he like wanted to show him, but I'm sure it's like the same gobbledygook I saw before.
The next day, we leave Manila. Was I expecting Jim to confess? Maybe a little. But I think I just wanted Jim to convince me, even for a moment, that the gold bullion and the treasury bonds and the caves filled with cash were real. So I could get why my dad believed him for so long.
All right. It's all in for me.
My dad died with almost nothing. And he lied about his losses to the people who loved him most.
It's driving me crazy.
Yeah, well, It's destroyed me.
This call is from July 2010, the year before he died.
I'll never recover from it. But I pray to God that my family does. Even though none of them are going to be talking to me. None of them are talking to me.
But that's not true.
None of my friends are talking to me. Just alone.
He wasn't alone then. His family talked to him. He had friends. He wasn't talking to us.
That's sometimes where it gets me the most angry, is I just wish he just would have been like, I'm doing bad.
This is my brother, Patrick.
Like, we got hit bad.
Yeah. I think it would have been so nice for him to know that we loved him even without money.
That was the moment that we didn't get, I guess, is just finally just being like, money doesn't define us as a family. We should just be people that like care about each other and just understand each other. And I think step one would have been just Dad being straight up about when things went bad. But he didn't know how to.
Hi, Maggie. This is...
2 months after getting back from Manila, I got this voicemail.
Yes, I would like to talk to you. And I hope... not that I hope, but I'm scared that your father was Terry Robinson that died so early.
I had reached out to many of Jim's relatives through phone calls and letters, and Julia, that's the name I'm giving her, was the only one who wanted to talk.
That's why I didn't invite you to the house, because we just do not talk about James Stuckey.
Julia's husband despises Jim. So I met her and her son in a studio close to her house instead.
It happened to everybody something, right? Yeah. That's why I wanted to meet you and, yeah. You know, you're not left alone.
Yeah.
Julia knew Jim well. She was Jim's stepdaughter. Her mother was married to him until she died in 2008.
She loved him. And love is blind.
In 2000... she says Jim and her mother went to the Philippines for the first time.
I told my mother what I think about it, but my mother, she went also so deep with Jim that she had to believe, but then at certain point she gave up. Yeah.
What were those certain points?
Always tomorrow and never anything else. Always tomorrow, tomorrow.
In 2002... Julia's mother came back from the Philippines while Jim stayed behind.
And my mother never understood, you know. There were times when she wrote in her diary that that's it. If you're not coming back, then I'm applying for a divorce. But unfortunately, she died before that.
Her mother wrote about my dad in her diary, too.
This is in Polish, my mother's diary. Your father spoke with Jim, and Jim... introduce him to the business, which one he is doing.
Who was my dad to Jim?
Who was your father to Jim? I think an investor.
And, yeah, sorry, I just was very struck. What did you think about Jim?
He was an interesting character.
This is Julia's son. Did you ever hear anything about the Philippines?
I remember hearing about the Philippines. I remember them always going. I even remember my mom coming to me asking for money for Jim.
I took his money.
Really?
Yeah.
How?
Birthday money, anything that he had. I took the money away from him and gave it to my mother. Because my mother was on my back and she needed the money to send to Jim because Jim didn't have anything to eat except crackers. My mother came to this country. She had a dream like everybody else. She started working for New York Life Insurance Company. She bought herself a beautiful car. She bought the house. She helped me to buy a house. And then she ended up going to a dollar store for hot dogs. So she could have food. So she could send Jim money. Well, that's okay. It happened. Maybe that's what she wanted to do.
So do you think that Jim believes that there still is something?
he wasted his beautiful life, you know, chasing dreams. For me, that's what I think. Chasing something that does not exist.
You really think, like, deep down he 100% believes in it?
Yes.
What makes you think that?
I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe I don't want to believe that he took my mother and all of us for a ride. I don't know. You know, at this point, you have your own feelings. Believe what you believe. I believe what I believe. But don't chase. Don't dig. It was, it went, it's not coming back.
I appreciate the advice, but I have spent 15 years not digging, not understanding my dad and his late night phone calls. So I will ignore Julia. I'm going to listen to the tapes again and re-examine the photos Jim sent my dad and keep calling people, all in the hope that this will start making sense. I keep telling myself it will. One day. Maybe tomorrow.
Maggie Robinson-Katz. Our story, The Long Distance Con, was produced by Daniel Guimet of WNYC Studios with Ben Katz and Mac Montandon. And if you missed any part of our story, you can find it at newyorkerradio.org or on our podcast. Now, for the record, Jim Stuckey disputes a couple of points in our account. For one thing, he says he never asked Vivian Cobb for money after the death of her husband, and he also says his own family never sent him money from the U.S. while he was in the Philippines. Maggie Robinson-Katz leads a cover band called Doll Parts, and she recently got her friends and family together for a kind of tribute concert for her father, where they played some of his favorite songs. I'm David Remnick. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.